"Honour me? What did I do?" Alia squeaked from under the covers. "What did she do?" I asked suspiciously. "What did she do?" Bova asked impatiently. "Why, nothing less than building and blessing the most perfect creamery in the Western lands. No better place has been prepared for the production of cheese than her dairy. I have come to bless its grounds personally and bestow blessings on the faithful daughter of the herds who saw it to fruition." "I did pay for it," I grumbled as I got to my feet, "and I did some of the enchantments. That earned me an eye roll from a goddess whose expressive eyes are legendary." "She is the mistress of the creamery," Bova insisted. "To her falls the glory." "Fine. I'll just stay out of the way," I sighed, as I directed the megalith out of the way. It was highly reluctant to do so, surprisingly, as if it didn't trust my judgment about the goddess of the kine. Without asking, I quietly summoned insight, both to observe the occasion and to provide a distraction if things went awry. I mean, when a full-fledged cow goddess manifests in your bedroom in the middle of the night, wanting to bless your wife for her devotion to cheese, what could possibly go wrong? "Countess Alia of the Mage Law," Bova said, as she calmly approached my terrified wife. "Your great attention to every detail in the preparation of the creamery has provided an example to all who seek to harness the wholesome goodness of the sacred milk," she explained.
"An example?"
Alia asked, confused. The goddess began lecturing, preaching, pronouncing, prophesying. I was a bit out of my element here.
"The nourishment of life is the most blessed, wholesome of all activities," she began with calm assurance. "Yet, though the blessings of life pour forth from the teat, it takes the skill and attention of a human heart to transform that raw blessing into the boon of prosperity. Separating the curd of human kindness away from the whey of human misery with the rennet of good judgment gives us holy purpose," Bova insisted, raising one large hand for emphasis. "When the curds are cut and drained, they can be salted with the tears of our struggles and joys, pressed into the form of nature and culture to create the wholesome prosperity all aspire to. But that is not the end," Bova said dramatically.
"It's not?" Alia asked, more confused than frightened now.
"Nay, that is but the beginning," she said, her eyes flashing and her nostrils flaring. "The wholesome prosperity of youth prepares you for the greater mystery. For the true art in this blessed transformation is to allow the sacred wheel of your soul to be wrapped in the cloth of your faith, placed in a haven of contemplative darkness, and then allow the trials of age and experience to manifest on your earthly rind whilst the fungus of wisdom grows. Only in the fullness of time can that great wisdom be manifested. Then, when the pairing born of tribulation comes, you are truly ripe in the maturity of your human wisdom," she declared triumphantly. Alia just stared at her. I could only guess at the thoughts going through her mind. My mouth blurted mine out.
"You just created an entire theology based on cheese," I gasped, in wonder and confusion.
"Related, not created," Bova corrected firmly, "for the sacred truth has always been there, to be discovered by my disciples and cultivated across time, as it should be."
"I was just trying to make good cheese," Alia mumbled.
"You tried to make great cheese,"
the cow goddess affirmed, "and you did it with a pure heart," she added gently.
"You sought neither profit nor envy from your cheesemaking. A creamery begun with such pure intent and genuine desire naturally attracted my notice. Having a sacred milk sister properly conduct the rites was just cream on top of the crock," she smiled. "My priesthood rarely gets the respect it deserves, sadly."
"So, just what does this blessing entail?" I wondered aloud, holding insight casually in my hand.
I reward thee with a herd of surpassing magnificence, Bova declared. Their milk shall never fail, and from its products the greatest cheeses in the western lands shall come. Of great virtue shall the milk be, and all that comes from it. Thy hands shall be especially blessed. You shall calm and direct all kine with a touch, when used in the craft. And when thou shalt chance to churn, mighty shall the vision be in thy eye. A wholesome feeling shall come upon all who consume thy works. Healing and peace shall overtake those who eat of thy cheese and thy butter and drink of thy cream and milk, she pronounced as she laid her hand on Alia's head in a blessing. Insight went a little crazy. My connection with my baculus, or more properly, the ancient enneagram my magical stick was imbued with, was always pretty quiet and friendly, compared to, say, dancing with the handmaiden. But when Bova gave her benediction to Alia, there was a wave of magical power that emanated from the goddess that sent my baculus into hysterics. Nor was the megalith unaffected. I had to physically restrain it from flying angrily at the goddess for interfering with my wife. I struggled to get my magical implements under control as I witnessed a powerful, divine blessing in my bedroom. I admit it, I have a complicated life. Once I managed to keep my toys from leaping around and doing dangerous things, which took an assertion of magical will, the transformation, or whatever it was complete. Alia didn't look any different particularly. Bova looked smug and satisfied. There, she sighed, her great bosom heaving. My blessing is bestowed. My purpose is fulfilled. And now I expect you want to discuss a few things before you lose your manifestation, I predicted. Brigger and Harris suggested you might. The cow goddess looked at me with discernment. I am aware of your power to bestow persistence on the gods, wizard, but the decision for you to grant it is yours alone. As a goddess of wisdom, I cannot make it for you. You're a goddess of wisdom, I asked, confused. I thought Brigger was the goddess of wisdom. She's the goddess of inspired wisdom, Bova said patiently. I'm the goddess of contemplative wisdom. There's a difference. Sometimes wisdom comes in sparks and flashes. Sometimes it comes when you're chewing your cud. Blame the Imperials. They're the ones who ascribed all these abstract concepts to us simple folk divinities, she said, rolling her eyes. But my contemplative wisdom recognizes that wizards, despite the best intentions, will do what they will, quite apart from any reasonable perspective. Okay, that's fair, I admitted, after I tried to find a counter to her argument. So, I have to decide if it's a good thing to grant you permanent manifestation, I realized. You're not going to ask or bargain for it like, well, like some others. That is not my way. Bova nodded somberly. If you decide to grant me the boon, I will accept it. If you decide to deny me, that, too, I will accept. That's uncommonly agreeable for a goddess, I pointed out. I didn't say I wouldn't be pissed off, she replied evenly. I'm just letting you know that I will accept your decision. Well, I'm a little concerned that you just cast a bunch of unknown spells on my wife, I pointed out warily. Nothing I blessed her with will be to her detriment, Bova promised. Indeed, it might have some small soothing effect on her condition. It would have been nice if you asked my permission, Alia said grumpily. Goddesses rarely ask for permission about such things, Bova sniffed. Whether she sought it or not, she earned it. But I see all things one of the kind see, for all cow's eyes are my eyes, she informed us. I have witnessed the kindness and care you provide for your beasts. You are a worthy recipient of my divine power. I suppose, agreed Alia, still confused. I do feel a bit different. Should I grant you persistence, O Milk Mother, To what benefit can you be in the struggles ahead? I asked carefully. Is she pledged to increase our numbers? Hera's pledged to bring us news. Crowther lends us cheer, and Slagor teaches us with games. Sisu, well, he hunts a lot. Goblins in particular, I added. I am not a martial goddess, save at great need, Bova admitted quietly. Yet I may provide support and give aid in unexpected ways. I'm not particularly fond of goblins, she added. They slaughter the herds they find and delight in the terror of my poor children. I didn't know if she was discussing my people or the cows, and I didn't really want to know, I decided. I expect that we'll have really excellent cheeses, at least, I ventured with a sigh. Of course, she affirmed, and butter of surpassing quality. Butter, I nodded. Of course, can't forget the butter. All right, goddess, I don't see much harm in granting you this boon, and perhaps a little benefit in the long run. I will make you persistent, I decided, as I rummaged around for the ring with the hoxter that contained the Alaran stone, the only known magical artifact with the ability to make an enneagram, even a god's, permanent. We appreciate the blessings, I nodded, and Alia joined me. And I welcome you to the new pantheon. Just let's keep the midnight divine visitations to my bedchamber to a minimum, shall we? I asked, in what I thought was a reasonable tone. The proper place to address a divinity is within their temple, suggested the goddess, patiently. I sighed. Of course it does. I shall get right on that. Damn it, I was building more temples than castles lately. When I was done, Bova had the grace to thank me and offer me some small blessing, as well as several long-winded pieces of general advice about ruling and wizarding and parenting, of all things, before she departed to the sound of cowbells. I felt Alia's arms cling to me as she faded. What in nine hells just happened, husband? She whispered anxiously in my ear. You were blessed by the cow goddess Bova, bearer of burdens, and I made her a persistent divinity, which means she'll be hanging around with all the others now. Min, I think she did something to me, Alia said quietly. She blessed you, I agreed. Just what that entails, thaumaturgically speaking, I don't know. It's more a matter of theurgy. I just feel different. Changed, she insisted. Would you mind if Insight took a look? I asked. I know you've been through a lot tonight, but I'd like to examine what she might have done, and maybe have the handmaiden do her treatment, I suggested. If you think that's wise, she agreed. Insight revealed a number of small changes wrought throughout her enneagram, and even some physical alterations that were subtle but detectable. The interesting thing to me was that they weren't really thaumaturgic signatures in the changes, the way there would be under normal spell work. The changes Insight related seemed completely natural by comparison. If Insight had not previously examined her, you would never have known she'd been altered. The handmaiden was more aggressive in its judgment than Insight. Once the glowing green sphere hovered above my wife, pulsating with the distinctive thaumaturgic purr it emitted when the ancient enneagram was working, it seemed to act with more purpose than usual. It was as if the handmaiden resented her charge being interfered with, no matter what divine pedigree was involved. Two important things came from the event. First, when we woke up the next morning, there were five new beautiful, shaggy brown cows and a fuzzy, well-spirited young bull in Spell Garden's new byre. The milkmaids were astonished at their appearance, and the milk from them came in abundance and was delicious, blessed or not. The other important thing that happened was the new sense of calmness that overtook Alia after Bova's visitation. It hadn't made her any less prone to sudden fits and bizarre visions and dreams, but they were less violent in nature after the bearer of burdens blessed her. She was also more attentive to the children, which was gratifying, and a little more interested in events around her. The fact that she was also even more devoted to her new herd and her creamery was a small price to pay. All in all, Bova's visitation was beneficial, but it gave me great pause. Bova was a minor goddess, a peasant goddess, and one who, by all accounts, very rarely manifested. While I appreciated her assistance, I couldn't help but think that I was attracting a fairly low class of divinity. On the other hand, considering how complicating each of the gods was in their own way, that might be a good thing. Bova was an inconvenience. Having Duin or Orvitas or any number of other divinities show up in my bedroom and wake me up in the middle of the night could prove disastrous. I don't always wake up pretty. The entire matter gave me a great deal of unease. As a wizard, I was naturally suspicious of the unexplainable, miraculous nature of divine magic. It could do things that thaumaturgy, or even the song spells of the Alka alone, could not fathom. The nature of the gods and their manifestation has always confounded and perplexed my profession, and the supposed blessings they bestowed on the devout among us were often dubious, if the law was any indication. Yet I could not deny the importance of the divine in the tasks ahead of me. Brigger had been invaluable, and Harris had done great work on my behalf. Even Ishii had provided insights into the nature of the undead most gods would have missed. Their willingness to take my advice, and sometimes my direction, could very well be key to determining the future. Indeed, I could not see a future where it wasn't, for good or ill. I didn't know what that meant for me. I was mortal, human, all too human. As learned and supposedly wise as I was supposed to be, I was profoundly aware of my own ignorance about such things. Not even the gods seemed to be able to explain their own nature to me, leaving me hints and vague suggestions but no real guidance. They were even asking me to make decisions that affected the course of divine events, and I was fairly certain I would find a way to screw that up in spectacular fashion. What was even worse was the fact that they didn't seem to mind that possibility. They seemed content to let a mortal wizard blunder around with powers and responsibilities far beyond his ken or control. That seemed like a terribly unacceptable risk to my mortal mind. It certainly didn't inspire a lot of faith. What kind of universe were they running anyway? Chapter 15. The Gates of Murashk. The rules of war? There are none in the heat of battle. Will the Lord Proverb, from the collection of Janik the Rish. One fateful day, the spring rains finally stopped. The rivers surged and flooded, and then they began to recede, as they were wont to do this season. While the trees and plants that surrounded them seemed determined to turn as much of that water into lush, vibrant foliage, we all knew it wouldn't be long until the rivers fell back to their normal banks and usher in the season for war. Our steps came with renewed purpose at the thought of war. As busy as we were, we had felt secure as long as the roads were muddy and the rivers high. When the wilderlands began drying out from the long early spring soaking, it was only a matter of time before Shakathet's legions felt confident enough to emerge from his fortresses and attack. That was as much inspiration for haste as anyone needed. Thousands of men had marched down the muddy trails from Vanador and taken positions along the line we proposed to defend. Thousands more had taken to horse and gathered at Megalin, where Azar and his knights prepared them for battle. Wenik and Rustalo led hundreds of men from the Pearwoods and the southeastern baronies in my realm, mostly on foot, to fortify Forgemont, and that was just one contribution. The Peeled Towers had contributed mightily. Hundreds of war magi prepared spells at scores of fortifications and outposts across the land. In the east, Carmella's great wooden engines were rushed to new emplacements, placed by Hoxter or pulled by teams of oxen. And in Vanador town, thousands of nimble hands prepared bandages, banners, and field rations for the war effort. On the Street of Steel, backs were bent over forges and anvils, and hammers flew to craft as many weapons and as much armor as they could. It was a busy, anxious time. While my people were given confidence and experience with their victory over Gadja Katar, the threat of Shakathet's legions was known to be greater. While they were better armed and armored than they had been in winter, most would be fighting far from home, with little hope of relief should things go awry. The faces I saw in the markets of Vanador and the grim expressions of the men marching south told me just how determined and desperate the folk of the Mage Law were. Spring brought foreboding along with its promise of hope that year, and all knew that summer would not arrive without the stain of blood. Mavone's secret scouts provided the exact time when Shakathet committed to the attack. The watchers reported when the long, sinuous, dark banner over his fortress was changed for a short, square, dark banner with what had to be his personal sign, a jagged bolt of lightning striking a stylized sun, both in a pale, sickly yellow against the grey-green fabric of the banner. Perhaps it suited Alka Alon's artistic sensibilities, but it was lacking in terms of human heraldry. To us, it looked a bit like a flower with a badly mangled stem. But at the signal, things started happening around his staging area. Legions began forming up. Siege worms began being herded into line. Great wagons and wains full of supplies were hauled to the road from the squat warehouses around the old castle. Hundreds of Gavanni scouts, riding fell hounds, began ranging the route ahead. And, most foreboding of all, the eaves and square towers of the old keep became infested with the poison-fanged wyverns, both the large and small variety. The activity gave us notice, and Mavone's men began quietly withdrawing from their hidden outposts in the penumbra, while the Skyriders began patrolling the place high overhead. Reports began coming into his headquarters hourly, once that happened. The great map that Mavone had prepared became peppered with markers, each holding down a slip of parchment detailing each report of the unit and its composition. The cenacle of wizards who communicated with various forces assembled nearby were diligent with their messages, and dispatches and reports began to arrive with increased frequency. Mavone read every one. This was his most important duty in the war, and he was attentive to it. Terlaman checked with him regularly, and Sandoval and the other commanders haunted the chamber to see how their foe was developing in his march. I don't think I'd ever seen Sandy so agitated, even during the Battle of Spellgate. I don't think I'd ever seen Mavone so anxious. Once again, I tried to stay out of their way and look confident. I was involved, of course. From time to time, there were decisions that my staff felt I needed to make and be responsible for. I was also as well informed as I could be about the state of preparation and the disposition of our foe. I spent plenty of time reading dispatches and studying maps, as well as hearing reports from the senior staff. In the early days of the campaign, most of what I read about concerned the great fortress of Muroshk. Mage maps, drawings, and field reports painted a somber picture. Mavone's ravens continued to scout Muroshk thoroughly, and without too much danger. As adept as Shakathet might have been at building an army, he didn't understand counterintelligence much. One of Mavone's outposts remained undiscovered within 200 yards of Muroshk's dark gate, and it was abandoned only when his forces began assembling. Other posts were farther out, but even better positioned to surveil our foe. The intelligence they gathered painted a compelling picture of Shakathet's intentions. When the day finally came when the great war banner above the dark tower changed, and horns blew deep and forebodingly from its towers, we knew Shakathet was finally ready. The gates opened, and the scouts poured forth as our spies watched and counted. Hundreds and hundreds of fell hound cavalry, most ridden by one or two Gavanni warriors, padded across the muddy track and out into the old abandoned fields of the Saramine Wilderlords, a family famous for its feuding and among the first lost to the invasion. Other brutes were riderless, but no less fierce. Indeed, they wore leather harnesses affixed with sharp studs and even blades to make them more dangerous in battle. All began to range eastward, screening the roads and forests and patrolling the flanks of the assembling army, the way cavalry is supposed to do. For days they spread out over the fields around Muroshk and ranged the penumbra, the largely uninhabited no-man's land between Korbal's lands and our own. There were no real villages left in the region to burn and sack. The few human settlements in the penumbra were mere outposts, or the isolated folk who called themselves the Free Lords of the Penumbra. Everyone else had long fled from the shadow. Interestingly enough, Mavone, with the help of Janik the Rish, had managed to cultivate relations enough with these stubborn folk that many had provided intelligence, or even assistance, against the hounds of Moroshk, and the Free Lords were no cowards. The penumbra is often considered desolate, and compared to its past, the land is both depeopled and ruined. The fertile vales had been gutted of their agricultural base, leaving but few remnants. The invasion stripped away most of the flesh from the vibrant Wilderlands culture, but the bones yet remained. In places inconvenient for the Gavanni legions to devour, or too remote to reach without intention, humanity lingered. Like weeds growing defiantly through the cracks in a castle wall, the people of the penumbra were few in number, but where they did cling, they dug in stubbornly. Most were residents of manors and freeholds of the most rustic sort, particularly those enjoying some natural defence, of which the craggy hills of the penumbra had an abundance. Why they persisted in such treacherous conditions, when better lives and fortunes could be had in the east and the south, was a private matter. For some, the idea of flight from lands won in conquest by their ancestors wounded their pride. For others, the utter lack of civil authority of any sort brought newfound prosperity to their protected lands by default. For yet others, the prospect of constant danger had some allure that compelled them to stay and fight for their lands, again and again. For their lot was near constant peril, not merely from the more organized Gavanni lands to the west, but from their bellicose peers and the bandits who now prowled the forests like terminal scavengers, picking bare the last bits of flesh from the land. Some penumbra lordlings and bandit kings had turned renegade, and had gone so far as to swear fealty to Shirul and the Goblin King. Korbal's lieutenants did not consider themselves obliged to respect those oaths. That put the penumbra lords in a bind. Now that their goblin patron was in exile, so was their power to call upon the Gavanni legions to uphold their rule. Others had clung to old titles, or created their own, to justify their lordship over their holdings. Only a few maintained their allegiance to the Duke, and whatever power had been placed over them by their sovereign, and among those Mavone found the best allies. But most of the penumbra lords fought for survival and left such political concerns alone. They were the ones who proudly proclaimed their freedom in the penumbra, free from sovereign rule, petty regulation and formal justice. They styled themselves Free Lords of the Penumbra, and were an odd collection of idealists, bandit kings and generally stubborn, pig-headed warriors, both noble and common-born. The only law they followed was the one they could enforce at the point of a sword. Mavone had convinced a few of these lordlings to take up arms, paying in newly minted silver or in livestock. Indeed, he found them far more eager for cattle than for coin, as most of the abundant stock in the Wilderlands had long ago been consumed. When the gates of Moroshk opened, and the fellhound riders began to range, they fought viciously to keep their precious cows safe and the Gavanni wary of ranging too far from the site of their castle. The Free Lords did little actual damage, but their resistance gave Mavone a little time and a lot of intelligence about how our enemy was moving, and that was invaluable. For Shakathet was preparing to advance. After the canine cavalry, the first great legions of Gavanni infantry began to move forward, to allow the castle to assemble more. A great, dark force gathered at the gates of Moroshk and began to spread out toward the east like a malevolent spear. Once the rivers receded and the muddy ground began to dry, the great wains and siege engines he was building were hauled to the road by his siege worms, and his great army mobilized in earnest. As voracious as Mavone was for the many detailed accounts he was receiving, he still wasn't satisfied until he laid his own eyes on the situation. He arranged for one of our erstwhile allies in the penumbra to provide shelter for his ravens on a hill about a half mile away from Shakathet's seat, and he had one of his agents establish a waystone there. Once his men were withdrawn, this was the most forward-situated outpost he had. It was well concealed, both physically and magically. The complicated approach to the top of the stony hill was guarded by a motley collection of locals and a handful of Mavone's ravens. He invited me and the rest of the military staff to view the enemy from that vantage, once he'd secured the site. He had us arrive one at a time through the ways, instead of coming all together, as he did not want to attract too much attention, magically speaking. His concerns seemed a little obsessive, but Mavone wasn't taking any chances on a surprise attack or assassination attempt. He's thorough and careful. That's why I had hired him. When we'd all arrived, he used his baculus to project an image from a magical construct he had emplaced near enough to the front gates to serve as an efficient spy. From the angle of the image, it had to be up in a tree somewhere, but it was well placed enough for us to see the churning anthill of evil that opposed us. In that one moment, it became stunningly clear just how vast an army Shakathet had assembled at the crumbling old castle. Moroshk was a dark blight on the green lands around it. Shakathet's tenure had seen a rise in the place's fortunes, even if it had done little for the decor. There hadn't been much to start with. The fortress was situated on a high hill, once the hall of some Wilderlord family of repute. Now it hulked there, beyond the edge of the penumbra, and gathered malevolent strength. It might have been a grand old hall once, when it was a Wilderlord keep. It was a depressing and dreary place now. The streaky grey granite used to build the original castle had looked like grainy soot during the best of times. Now it looked horrid. The expansions and improvements the Gavanni and the Nemovorti made had only spread that stain across the original hilltop and across the barren meadows and tortured fields. Great sheds, as large as guild halls, were filled with provision from the slave farms of the penumbra. Sprawling encampments of legion after legion of Gavanni gathered. Trolls were bivouacked in one shallow vale, near to the great fields of siege engines and other constructions, and a great herd of siege worms were stabled in an open corral. They were being fitted with the engines and castellets they would bear into battle. Terrible and foul was the great stain of Moroshk. Terrible and foul, and really, really muddy. Spring rains in the Wilderlands are brief and intense, usually, but they occur daily during the season. The thirsty meadows and woodlands absorb much of the rain quickly, but the rest runs off into the many rocky streams that seem to lay everywhere. That is, unless you've had 50,000 goblins marching back and forth across it. Then it turns into a muddy, sodden mess. The smear of Moroshk had been churned with thousands and thousands of reluctant steps, some inspired by the lash, some bearing great burdens, and all tearing the ground apart. I knew from brutal personal experience just how miserable mud could make an infantryman. I couldn't imagine the lashes of hobgoblin overseers would have improved the experience. "That's a lot of goblins," Sandy muttered as he stared at the image. "To be fair, there's a lot of trolls and hobgoblins down there too," Turlamon said cheerfully. "And look at all the siege worms." "The majority of Shakathet's late cavalry has already been deployed," Mavone said, before Sandy could say something rude. "At least 2,000 fellhound riders. He seems to have drained every kennel in the penumbra for this effort, and their patrols are being careful, too. Much harder to pick apart than the pups we face this winter," he said authoritatively. "Let's hope he's as foolish with their use as Gudja Katar was," muttered Turlamon. "But I fear not. The way those units are deployed indicates a far more organized military mind and a better officer corps." "As well as a real magical corps," I agreed, as I used insight to evaluate the spell work below. "Every unit has a goblin spark among their grunts, or an enshadowed officer armed with ancient sorcery. They're protected, at least from basic war magic." "That just means we have to get creative," Sandy said with a sigh. "But it also means that some of our tricks won't work on them. Ishi's tits. Look at how well covered the vanguard is by anti-detection spells. I don't think Gudja Katar managed that level of sorcery in the thick of battle, much less before he began marching." "And look at that siege train," Turlamon nodded, calling up an image of the vast field in which scores of mangonels and catapults, as well as bundles I could not identify, were being prepared for deployment, pulled into place by great trolls surrounded by thousands of Gavanni artillerymen. "They come prepared to destroy castles. More than one, by the sheer number of devices, and they are well defended by both Hound and Scrug," he noted conversationally. Clearly, we face a general who understands war, Mavone agreed solemnly. They are still assembling the baggage train, but my spies have told me that they have more than a sufficiency of stores to keep the army in the field for months, and their supply line back to their stronghold is far shorter than Gajakatar's was from his. Hunger will not be our ally in this campaign, he warned. Nor the weather, I'm afraid, I agreed as I disengaged my baculus from scrying. Warm, clear skies for the next few days, from what the weather-wise have predicted. If we are to defeat Shakathet, we'll have to do it honestly. This is going to be a fight, I announced. We all stood there a moment in silence, contemplating the great task ahead of us. This force was as large as the army we stopped at Timberwatch. Only I'd had twice the men I'd had then, and our foe was little acquainted with our methods of warfare. Now they knew us and our style of combat as well as any feudal lord. Arrogance and pride had not convinced Shakathet to arm himself as if he were fighting against Alka Alon in the wars of old. He had learned, and we could see he had taken the advice of counselors and undertaken a meticulous preparation for war as he found it, not as he desired it. Wyverns, Sandy said suddenly, as he pointed with his staff. Look, how many, he demanded, as he began to improve his scrying to find out. Over 100. And we have less than 50 of Skyriders, Mavone said, troubled. Minilan, we might not control the skies this time. Our birds are bigger, I reasoned, and better equipped and led. Notice that only a few of them have riders, no more than 12 out of 100. The advantage of the Skyriders is how much power they can deploy on the field, or in the sky, in this case. Don't worry. When Natia's birds are in the air, they will find themselves superior to the Wyvern riders. And hopelessly outnumbered, Sandy argued. Look how many regular-sized Wyverns there are amongst the giants. Do you remember how vicious they were at Olam Saheri? He reminded me. This isn't good, men. That will require some adjustment of our tactics, Telemann proposed. Our castles are not warded against attacks from the air. Wyverns can be brought down by arrows, of which we have a plenty, Sandy pointed out, and magic. But it is going to complicate things. It's like having to manage an entirely separate cavalry. It's just another factor in battle, shrugged Telemann. Let me think on it, and perhaps we can raise a novel defence. And perhaps we can all get slaughtered by the fangs and claws of those things, Sandy said crossly. They must be using magic to control them, too. They don't have the resistance that dragons do, thank the gods. But that also means that the Nemavorti and the Black Skull Priests can augment their powers if they care to. Let's hope that doesn't occur to them, I said, shaking my head. All right, my friends, we've seen the beast of an army that faces us. We know their strength. We know their numbers. We can guess their tactics. The only thing we lack is knowledge of whence they march, agreed Mavone, though the question of when can be answered by how quickly they are mobilizing. Fort Destiny appears to be their first stop. We shall see how well they fight there. There's no guarantee of that, Sandy objected. They could easily turn towards Megalyn, of our own. Both are within the range of their march. If they arrive with this army intact, they can overwhelm either one. Fortune will dictate which direction they march, Telemann decided. Our forces aren't mobile enough to adapt to either plan. Is there any sign of dissension in Shakathet's ranks? He asked Mavone suddenly. You wish to encourage a mutiny? The Gilmoran asked. Sadly, his enshadowed lieutenants are loyal, fiercely so, and capable. They were the cream of Sherul's best. His troops respect his orderly nature and fear his wrath. A repeat of the rebellion against Gajakatar is unlikely. This one is going to be bad, Min, Sandy advised. I can see that, I sighed, slinging insight over my shoulder like a spear or a hoe. If we cannot depend upon the incompetence of our foe, then we'll just have to contend as best we can and find other means to defeat him. I recommend we cheat, Sandy declared. I agree. But how? Mavone asked. However we can, I answered. Well, we have our work laid out for us. Let's try to overcome our doubts and apply ourselves to the problem. The urgency I felt after actually seeing our foe in the field compelled me to take stock of our situation. If we were going to have to cheat, as Sandy suggested, I needed to think of every possible way we could accomplish that. I didn't try to interfere with how Sandy trained our troops, or how Turlamon deployed them, but I did have a few ideas I wanted to consider. That evening, I summoned Tyndall to Spellgarden for a private audience. "What is your friend Atopold doing at the moment?" "Cat?" Tyndall asked, surprised. "I assume he's still helping Anguin ferret out rebellion and reorder an Ultramar. But then I haven't spoken to him in a while," he admitted. "Why?" "See if he's interested in doing a little work for me," I suggested, without elaborating. "I'll pay handsomely." "He's got plenty of money," Tyndall dismissed. "I have an irresistible challenge for him," I offered. "That might actually get his interest," conceded my former apprentice with a chuckle. "You want him to pick Shakathet's pocket?" "Something like that." "We saw his army today," I admitted, hesitating a moment. I tried not to make a habit of thinking out loud, as it can startle those who don't know me well when I begin to babble, but this was Tyndall. "It was a big army, and well prepared. We'll be crossing swords with him in a week or so, and I need to find some leverage. I think I also need Lorcus." "That might be difficult," Tyndall frowned. "He's newly wed, and he enjoys his bride." "I heard. I'm as surprised as anyone," I admitted. "Who on Kalador would want to marry that man?" My mind whirled.
"But you were saying you need Lorcus," he reminded me when my silence endured too long.
"Yes, he would be ideal," I sighed, allowing him to drag me back to the moment at hand. "I need a high mage who can be as subtle as he is, who I can send on a mission or two for the war effort, someone with wit, and someone whom I can trust."
"Nutha?" he proposed.
"No, I don't trust her enough for this, and she's not really personally loyal to me. Besides, she's serving her father at the Royal Palace."
"Iyugi, then?" he suggested.
"He's in Wensha, looking into the Wensha situation for me. I don't want to drag him away from that."
Rondal's busy, Bannimal's busy, Lance is busy. Damn it, Minolin, you have everyone doing something.
Wait, what about Planus?" he proposed.
"Planus?" I asked, doubtfully.
"If it doesn't require a sword, he's pretty good about such things," my former apprentice admitted. "Subtle, loyal."
"You trust him?"
he counted off on his fingers. "Well, I suppose for this particular mission, he might serve. Could you make the inquiry?" I asked. "That way he won't feel compelled to agree just because I asked him to."
"How important a mission is this?"
Tyndall inquired, something occurring to him.
"Fairly, but it shouldn't require killing anyone, and I would rather incite his sense of adventure than trade on our friendship and business partnerships."
"I'll ask," Tyndall agreed. "All he can say is no."
"So, are you and your men prepared for the battles ahead?" I asked.
Tyndall wore his armor constantly now and looked every inch the dashing cavalry commander.
"Exceedingly," he agreed at once. "We've been drilling since we got back from the Penumbra. I've got a good company, all fine fellows, adept with lance and wand. And with this new armor Master Su he is producing, they'll each be as tough as siege worms on the field," he boasted proudly. "I have them encamped out by Yellin so that we're well positioned to be deployed wherever Turlamon needs us. But once we get there, they're ready for a fight," he promised.
"Good. They'll get one," I warned. When Tyndall left after a few more cups of wine, I was in much better spirits, despite the disturbing news from Moroshk. Ruderol accompanied me as I made my final rounds about the tower, ensuring that the guard posts were manned and the gates were locked. That seemed a bit pointless, considering there were 300 troops camped out in the Bailey, or where the Bailey would be when the wall was completed. But it was a ritual I had performed since the first days in Sevendor, under Sire Kay's guidance. He explained to me that it was the only way a lord could fall asleep, assured that he'd done all he could to protect the people within the walls, and it demonstrated to those people that someone in authority was overseeing their security. Certainly it was a ceremonial rite, as a good staff makes certain that such matters are faithfully attended to before they were inspected by their superiors. but it wasn't something I felt right about delegating too often, if I could manage it myself. A good lord made certain that he was seen attending to such details every time he could, my castellan had insisted. I tried to heed that advice. While I appreciated the political importance of such a display, in truth I valued the nightly round more for the opportunity to collect my own thoughts while making my way from post to post throughout the little castle. It took nearly 3/4 of an hour to make the circuit at Spellgarden. At Sevendore Castle, the nightly rounds took me over an hour to visit every post. It had often granted me a few quiet moments to put away the day's events, or at least get them in perspective before I retired to my chamber for the night. Ruderal faithfully attended me during the rounds, dogging my steps and casting mage lights for me while we walked. It was good practice for the boy, only newly come into his stone, and he was becoming adept at it, more quickly than any of my 3 previous apprentices. As we made the final check on the gate to ensure it was locked and well manned, the lad listened while I bantered with the 2 guardsmen who'd drawn the cold, lonely duty. On our walk back to Spellmonger's Hall, he cleared his throat. "Yes, Ruderal?" I asked.
"Master, why are you bothering with all of this... this?"
he said, indicating Spellgarden in general with his hands, "when there are more important things that need to be done. Tellerman has the war in hand. Shouldn't you be working on the Snowstone spell, or the Vundle, or something else?" he asked, confused.
"Well, perhaps I should,"
I sighed. "If you want to know the truth, and you of all people will know it is true, then you should understand that part of being a good wizard is knowing when to relax your attention on one factor and concentrate on another. Sometimes several others. It's part of the art in our craft to know when action is called for, and when it would be, well, counterproductive. There isn't much I can do about the Snowstone spell until the men I've put on to looking into it have more to report. Me standing over their shoulders, shouting at them to hurry, isn't going to improve either their understanding of it or the speed at which they will arrive at that knowledge. Similarly, there is nothing I can do about the more cosmic matters that face us. As troubling as your sire's warning about the end of magic was, that day is thousands of years away, and there is likely nothing I can do about that either at present. I cannot make the Alka Alon Council move more quickly, or wait for Prince Tavard to arrange a strike at me from a hidden corner, or much of anything else right now. Indeed, in most of those matters, me doing anything at all could upset the course of events in a way we would not enjoy. So, I do what I can, and right now, that's protecting those that I hold dear and the land that I rule from a walking corpse leading an army, and walking the rounds before bed to assure my men that I'm attentive to that task. And, for now, that's sufficient. One cannot be the spellmonger all the time," I philosophized. "Or, more properly, being the spellmonger means being able to contend with the cosmic and the mundane, and everything in between, with the appropriate amount of attention." We walked in silence for a while as Ruderal contemplated that. "So, it's something you do to kill time while you're waiting around," he suggested. "Waiting for something to happen." "Yes, that's essentially it," I chuckled. "Because I hate waiting around for something to happen. But making something happen because you're bored is usually an unwise thing to do. Patience isn't merely a virtue, Rudy. It's an essential component of our craft." "It's not one I particularly like," he said with disgust. "On that, we can agree," I nodded as we went up the steps to Spellmonger Hall. "Off to bed now. We have a war ahead of us. Best get your sleep." Chapter 16. The War Begins in Earnest. The war banners fly o'er castle wall. The horns call men to take up the spear. The drums of war thunder the call. The time of doom is skulking near. Traditional Wilderlands War Call, from the collection of Janik the Riche. When the day finally came, when the great war banner above the dark tower changed, and horns blew deep and forebodingly from its towers, we knew he was ready. The gates opened, and yet more scouts poured forth as our spies watched and counted. all began to range eastward, screening the roads and forests and patrolling the flanks of the assembling army the way cavalry is supposed to. Then the first light infantry battalions, the lightly armed Gavani who formed the vanguard, emerged from the dark gate of Moroshk. They led the long train of warriors that comprised Shakafet's horde. Their banners were unfurled, and as they took the field after the rain, they churned the very roadways into a muddy mess. But they were determined. Nay, they were relentless. They marched for 5 days straight, pausing only for a few hours in the heat of the sun and driving themselves through the night. Their column stretched for miles and miles. They marched upon the barren track without opposition for the entire 5 days. Though his spies watched them, Asher Karl had been unwilling to commit his meager forces to raids that might draw reprisals before he was ready to meet them. Mavone's ravens watched as well, counting every Gervan who crossed the threshold of the Dark Fortress. The van crossed the headwaters of the Anfal River, descending from the western highlands at Araton, a burned-out village at the ford of the river. It was the easiest access to the vales below, and the vast pack of evil hounds thundered through the ford, howling and baying as if they were chasing a rabbit. Behind them, the first legions of heavy infantry began marching, pulling themselves out of the sticky mud at the end of their master's whips and trudging across the landscape with relentless resolve. One troop after another took formation and marched, and to the ravens who observed, their numbers seemed endless. Worse, they seemed competent. If Gadja Katar's command had bred sloppiness and carelessness in his legions, Shakafet's discipline produced better results. The goblins who marched in his service were not enthusiastic about their mission, but they moved with purpose and determination. They were not conscripted tribal Gavani. These were the goblins and hobgoblins born of the breeding pits, and then raised for the express purpose of obeying their masters. There were no desertions. Then came the legions of great goblins, the Maragorku heavy infantry. Their greater height and girth made them appear almost as large as men, and they marched with an arrogance or pride that only veteran soldiers can muster. They had no remnant of the old warrior societies left in their culture. The Maragorku were soldiers, not warriors. They were trained to endure and to slay, and they measured their worth in the performance of their bloody duty. The enshadowed elite came next, most clad in their ancient warrior form, taller and spindlier than the great goblins that were their complement. They wore armor of Dradrian make and carried spears and bows as they marched. Drogon flanked their company, wild, red-eyed creatures who only vaguely resembled the dead men whose bodies they wore. And then the siege worms, pulling their engines or great wains, flanked and guided by trolls, while a few companies of slower-moving undead Gervani made up the rear guard. When the Fellhounds reached Araton, Shakafet's army stretched out behind it in one long malignant trail of horrors, and it continued to emerge from Moroshk, and continued. The ravens and the scrying wizards of the magical corps attempted to count every one as they passed their hidden blinds and through the subtle spell fields. When the last wagon, full of sour beer, left Moroshk, Mavone reported, gravely, there were nearly 84,000 goblins, trolls, hounds, and other foes on the march. That was about 20,000 more than we'd anticipated, and that was before another 10,000 more reinforcements joined them from the depopulated fortress of Savo Evital, Gadja Katar's former seat. I suppose that was all that was left of the garrison there. Shakafet was wringing every last body he could find to press the advance. The question on all of our minds was, advance to where? After Araton, Shakafet's armies were in relatively easy country to pass through. They could continue down the road east, perhaps the best-made avenue along their route, cross the Nar River, and come to face Fort Destiny and its enhanced garrison of 2,000 iron bandsmen. Or it could turn south and follow the Anfal River down to the escarpment, and thence to Megalin Castle itself. Or it could march betwixt the Nar and the Anfal, come to the road near Forgemont, and then descend on Megalin from the north by way of Altas. We didn't know which of the three ways they would take, or a combination of any of them. We prepared as best we could for each possibility, but it was nerve-wracking. 30,000 more goblins than we planned on made our decisions crucial. But once we were certain that Shakathet's hordes were bearing due east, Sandoval could sharpen his preparations. My marshal had been quite busy with that. Sandy had done wonders at Forgemont. The former baronial castle, now Cormoran seat, had been in general disrepair when he'd arrived, weeks ago. With a few weeks of magic, hard work, and a refreshed garrison of 300 Vanador guards, the place was now defensible and defended. Siege engines were going up on the towers and in the baileys. The fields beyond the moat were cleared and laid with spellworks, and the anvils rang far past midnight as the castle made ready. Wenwick and his Pearwoods clansmen volunteered to help sustain the castle. Master Cormoran insisted on commanding the defence personally. The time was past for forging swords. The time was now to wield them. Ironhill was strengthened with more guards, as well as a surly band of former bandits Iron Peg had persuaded to enter her service for the duration. I didn't blame them. Banditry was a poor business against the Gavanni. Iron Peg paid in silver, mostly my silver, and she'd gathered what few vassals she had to the squat fortress to help man the walls. Fort Destiny, the headquarters of the Iron Band, was the supposed jewel in the crown of the Iron Ring, the near-mythical attempt to encircle and contain the penumbra. While the band were decent soldiers, and well-trained at escorting caravans and patrolling the roads, they had only rarely endured a proper siege. With Sandy's help, they were provisioned for one now, and had called in reinforcements from as far away as Latanz to bolster the fortress. Lastly, Bendenal and Azar had eagerly accepted what aid Sandy could provide, but in truth, they had already done most of the work. The great baronial castle had been strengthened for years in preparation for a day such as this. Megalin was a garrison for thousands, including a professional infantry garrison and Azar's Megalini knights, more than 500 knights magi, war magi, wilderlords, and sergeants who had been training and fighting with Azar for years. They were all eager for a fight, and they felt well prepared for the worst that Shakathet could throw at them. I felt sorry for them all. Regardless of which castle he attacked, Shakathet would outnumber our defenders. It was clear that Shakathet was going to move through the region. He couldn't very well leave places like Megalin, Forgemont, and Iron Hill intact as he advanced without imperiling his rear and his supply train. So, Sandy was determined to harden all three sites as much as possible to delay the invasion and bog it down. Once he realized what that entailed, he repositioned about half of the magical core, and then fretted hourly on his decisions. The Wilderlands didn't seem to care about the struggles between Korbal and mankind. The season proceeded, heedless of our conflict, pursuing its own agenda. All the Mage Lore sprang into action the moment we could. Everyone worked with fresh purpose as the word went out. Moroshk had opened its gates and vomited a horde out into the countryside, a horde that was intended for the heart of our country. By the time I was ready to deploy to the field myself, thousands had already pushed southward to counter the Gavanni army. Sandoval kept me informed of our progress in daily briefings, mind to mind. On the whole, I was pleased. Thousands of men had marched down the muddy trails from Vanador and taken positions along the line we proposed to defend. Thousands more had taken to horse and gathered at Megalin, where Azar and his knights prepared them for battle, and significant garrisons had arrived at Forgemont, Iron Hill, and Fort Destiny. Militia units encamped at Yelin and beyond the Wildwater, mostly archers and light infantry, prepared to reinforce our positions as needed. Wenwick and Rustallo led hundreds of men from the Pearwoods and the southeastern baronies in my realm, mostly on foot, to form the reserves around Anguin's Tower. The Peel Towers had contributed mightily to the effort. We had, perhaps, the most well-developed magical corps in history, and Turlaman deployed them with precision. Hundreds of war magi prepared spells at scores of fortifications and outposts across the land. Scores of combat war magi drilled and equipped themselves with weapons and spells. In the east, Carmella's great wooden engines were rushed to new emplacements, placed by Hoxter or pulled by teams of oxen. Tyndall and Azar rode at the head of columns of cavalry, moving into position as Turlamon dictated. I came relatively late to the field, arriving at our field headquarters at Megalyn with a small staff, Ruderal, Atapol, and a few servants. Bendanal reserved a large chamber in one of the central towers for my use, close by to the impressive map room, where he and Azar had guarded these lands for years. That allowed me to see the progress of both our defence and the foes who were pouring through the penumbra like blood from a spurting wound, and they were marching far faster than we anticipated. They marched day and night for most of a week, pausing only for a few hours in the heat of the noonday sun and driving themselves through the night. Their column stretched for miles and miles. They marched upon the barren track without opposition. Shakafet's army was favoured by good weather and a lack of resistance. Mavone pulled our allies within the Free Lords of the Penumbra back from their flanks and sent his pet Kasari scouts into their concealed refuges as the ranks upon ranks of Gavani marched through. We'd anticipated that it would take them more than a week to reach the Anfal. It took them less than 5 days. They marched with purpose, toward a ford they knew they could cross and where we had no real defence. As we rushed troops to the garrisons across the eastern bank, the Gavani were quickly penetrating the western bank. For a few days, everyone was so busy conducting their missions that we barely slept. Telemann continued to stare at the maps and chew his lip as we all waited for the army to decide. For 2 days, Shakafet's horde encamped in a shallow vale while the rear caught up and made the ford. He would not proceed, apparently, until he gathered his full strength. While we waited, word came to me of another army on the move, this time from Gilmora. Count Anvaram has begun deploying his forces in a march northward, toward Lossara, Planus reported to me from Neon. He was there ostensibly on unrelated business, but it was a trip he'd arranged at my behest. While it was generally well known around Sevendor that the Remeran merchant mage and I were friends, I didn't think Anvaram was aware of it. Planus was able to disguise himself enough to appear as just another Remeran cotton broker while he was quietly reporting to me, mind to mind. "How many forces?" I asked. "At least 5,000 horsemen," the wizard replied. "About 2,000 are belted knights, the rest squires and sergeants. The vanguard looked like a bloody tournament," he said disdainfully, "or perhaps a festival ball. According to my sources, at least 2 units of mercenary archers are to join the force on the way north. I heard he gave quite the impassioned speech to his officers on the eve of his deployment. But they are underway," he emphasized cheerfully. 7,000, I asked with a sigh. "Thus far," Planus agreed. "But His Excellency seems to be very generous with his purse. His agents are hiring every free man with a sword that he can. That's Tavard's coin he's paying with, no doubt. How fast is he moving?" I asked. With Shakafet on our doorstep, I wanted to be certain about Anvaram's level of commitment. "He's planning to be in Lossara by the end of the week, if that's any indication. After that, he should be able to take the Great Western Road. If he can find supplies enough," he added. "He's picked the local markets bare for his campaign. His men are buying plenty of fodder and food and paying a good price. I made a tidy profit on 6 barrels of some Remeran salt cod and a couple of kegs of new wine I brought with me." "Wait, you sold provisions to my declared foe?" I asked, startled. "It's providing a good cover story," he dismissed. "Besides, the man isn't making war on me. Profit is profit," he reasoned. "If Tavard is overpaying for last year's cod and this year's wine, it would be a shame not to take his coin. He'll need it, too. Once he gets to the northern baronies, he's going to find supplies much harder to come by. He'll be eating from his baggage train until he makes Verone." When I was done speaking to Planus, I spent a few moments in quiet contemplation before I spoke with Atapol and Ruderal. I had an idea I wanted them to try. The Cat of the Shadows was spending his time teaching my apprentice how to use his witchstone to transport through the ways, a spell the young thief had found extraordinarily useful. When they heard what I proposed, Rudy was hesitant, while Atapol was enthusiastic about the mission. "I've never been to Gilmora," Rudy said uneasily. "Not by myself." "It's like Alshar. Only with worse food and more conceit, Atipol explained. Believe me, no one will even notice us, especially not with all the nobles off to war. Be certain you aren't noticed, I insisted. The last thing I need right now is to mount a rescue mission, and I don't think you'd want to involve your father in such a thing, Atipol. So, do look out for my apprentice. It will be fun, Atipol encouraged, and it will get you out of all this mud for a few days. Where are they off to? Mavone asked, as he arrived just as they left to go prepare for their mission. An errand for me, I dismissed. You have news?
I do,
he sighed heavily. I just came from the front. Shakathet has chosen a destination. At dusk, his vanguard began to march toward Fort Destiny. I winced. The Iron Band Fortress was the weakest of our strong points, the most lightly defended and poorly positioned castle in the way of the Horde. I'd hoped Shakathet would elect to avoid it in favor of a direct assault on Megalyn, but he seemed determined. How many men do we have there? I asked, hoping to hear a larger number than I did.
Just under 2,000.
They have a little artillery. The walls are stout, and they can give some fight, but their defeat is inevitable against Shakathet's entire horde. There's a waystone there, and we could evacuate it if we needed to, but it's going to get hit.
As we suspected, I sighed.
What's Telamon's plan?
He wants them to hold them as long as possible,
Mavone reported. Lure them into a siege, if they can, so we can take them from behind. But it won't be a long one, he warned. If I know Tal, it won't need to be. You've seen what he's planned, I reminded him, and I know the Iron Band. They'll hold, as long as we need them to. Those are the best of them at Fort Destiny. They're going to need to hold for this to work, Mavone agreed grimly. Shakathet has deployed his advance in a different manner, he explained. Instead of leading with light cavalry and following with infantry, then artillery and supply in the rear, he's included a bit of each of them in his advancing units.
That's odd,
I admitted, considering the reasons our enemy might do so. A departure from a standard procedure during a military advance was noteworthy.
It's brilliant, in a way,
Mavone said with reluctant praise. The way sieges usually happen is a slow pull back and resistance as the light cavalry arrive, then a few counterattacks before the gates are shut, and then a lot of waiting around and sniping from the walls as the infantry arrives. Then more sniping and waiting around as the sappers and artillery arrive or are constructed. This way, Shakathet can force a more abrupt and vicious siege by bringing his artillery and infantry to bear at once. Each succeeding wave only strengthens and speeds the attack, while pressuring the besieged, he explained. It also regulates the pace of march, I pointed out. They'll go more slowly with all that artillery, but it will ensure that no one part of the army outpaces another. That had been a major problem during the Faresian campaign, I recalled. Mavone nodded in agreement. It solves a lot of problems, but it creates some weaknesses. Perhaps we can exploit them, he suggested. How much time before they get there? I asked, my mind calculating. Telamon didn't have me playing a large part in the battle plan, but I did have a role. I wanted to be ready. Ordinarily, I'd say 3 days. But the way they're marching, they can be there in half that time, he said. So you have about a day before you will be called upon. That's plenty of time. I'll be in place and prepared, I promised. Just make certain everyone else is, too. Talaman's plan was actually fairly straightforward. He was trying to get Shakathet to become overly involved with the siege, where his forces would gather en masse and relatively few of our men were threatened. Once they were assembled, Tal would spring his trap, which involved a lavish amount of battlefield combat magic. But before then, I had another duty to perform to further the effort. I had to make peace between the two Muse Towers. Upon Telamon's request, I had called upon both Muse Towers to prepare their greatest force to fly against Shakathet's legions. Natia had been eager to continue the campaign. Indeed, her birds had been flying continuously all winter, patrolling and spying, as well as making select attacks. Her wing now had 3 squadrons of more than a dozen birds in fighting shape. A 4th squadron was just beginning training. Dara had been more reluctant to come to war, but she came prepared for battle. Her four wings brought 20 falcons west, and her riders were equipped with the best new battle enchantment Sevendor's brilliant enchanters could produce. The Sevendor birds tended to have more elaborate harnesses and were better armed. In contrast, the Vanador hawks were more sparingly harnessed and carried but half the armament. Only in the newly fashioned spurs on their talons did they exceed their eastern counterparts. The spurs had been recently built by Master Suhi of Iltadine steel to Master Camoran's design, and then heavily enchanted. I needed all 30 birds in the air, flying and fighting for us, if we were to survive Shakathet's hordes. My exile did not prohibit me from hiring my vassals for foreign wars. Dara reluctantly agreed to fly for me, after some consideration and a little bargaining. But she did agree, and her skyriders were eager to test their skills in battle. Just as the foe was beginning to cross at Araton, Dara transported her entire wing and their birds through the ways to Megalin, just before Natia's wing arrived from Vanador by air. The conflict began almost at once. Natia and Vanador Muse were barely speaking to the Sevendor Muse and its commander, Lenadara the Hawk Maiden. Once fast friends, the two red-headed women had argued bitterly a few years ago, resulting in a schism in more than distance or loyalty to Kor. It had become political. The split had seen acrimony on both sides, as the Vanadori riders felt deeply insulted by Dara, and the Sevendori riders largely saw Natia's corps as full of rebels. Neither captain was much inclined to make peace, but for this plan to go forward I needed some sort of reconciliation. I had planned a quiet drink and discussion with the two captains to relay my expectations that evening, and I greeted both units, but they didn't give me the chance. Bendanal quartered them both in the cavalry barracks. Azar had deployed to the field with the Megalini knights early on, and they were shadowing Shakathet's vanguard nearby. Most of the sergeants and light infantry of the Megalini were screening to the north. That left an entire square tower available. Even though there was plenty of room in the empty keep, Bendanal naturally bunked the wings of Skyriders together, unaware or uninterested in the rift between the two units. By the time I arrived to greet them, the two Muse were already at each other's throats. I don't know what youthful comment sparked the fight, but when I arrived in the Western Tower, summoned by Bendanal, Natia's Skyriders were actively engaged in an all-out brawl with Dara's corps. As most of them were nimble, lithe young people, it wasn't as punishing as most of the fights I'd seen around Vanador. But there was an element of viciousness that surprised and impressed me. Skyriders might not have a lot of weight behind their punches, but they were adept at hair-pulling, slapping, and tripping their opponents. To their credit, they didn't draw blades or wands. They used their fists to quarrel. But their birds were squawking and agitated on their perches, and a few had gotten loose and joined in the fray. By the time I was summoned to the hall to intervene, there were riders pummeling each other all over the place. Feathers were flying. I saw Alandreth, one of the new class of Natia's Muse, holding down a boy nearly twice her size, punching him in the face with both little fists, with an expression of utmost rage on her face. Laratha, Dara's lieutenant, had young rider Karasa pushed into a corner and was kneeing her indiscriminately in the thighs and groin while she hollered the most vile of epithets at the older girl. The two Talalon in Dara's third wing were gleefully hopping on the abdomen of Natia's scrawny second wing commander while he desperately tried to roll out of the way. I happened to be carrying my baculus. I slammed it into the wooden floor and activated a showy, loud cantrip that immediately announced my presence. "Stop!" I bellowed after taking stock of the situation. I was gratified that the megalith echoed my sentiment with a sharp, sudden burst of light. It was doing a lot of that sort of thing lately, independent of my stated desires. While it was concerning, it was also terribly helpful in the moment. "Everyone freeze!" I shouted until all activity came to a halt. In at least one case, that meant a fist poised only 6 inches from a rather delicate nose. "All Sky Riders assemble," I continued powerfully, hefting in sight over my shoulder like a hoe as I strode into the hall. There was a brief moment of confusion But then the Sevendori and Vanadori riders sorted themselves out, congregating on each side of the barracks. Natia's company quickly lined up by rank, an arm's length apart. Dara's folk mostly clumped around their captain. I surveyed them all with a steely eye, as their chests heaved and their faces began to redden from the fight. Natia's riders appeared more uniform, in the nearly identical gear she insisted upon. Dara's appeared more diverse, as they combined Rivalan's style with their own individual choices for their clothes. They continued to glare at their rivals across the gap between the units, but every eye was on me, fearful and outraged in equal degree.
"Thank you. You may not be aware," I began in a low, quiet voice, "but the threat I've summoned you to fight now outnumbers us by 5-1. Perhaps more," I lectured, as I fixed each individual rider with a stare in turn. "I've just spoken with Captain Mavone, and his report was dire. The enemy is singularly well-armed, well-equipped, and well-led. They are turning south from Araton and headed toward Fort Destiny, the headquarters of the Iron Band. They will arrive in a few days. When they do, the 2,000 men there will quickly be overwhelmed and the castle sacked if they don't receive abundant assistance from someone. That someone is you," I said, with emphasis, as I returned Insight's butt to the floor with a thump. "I am aware of the matter between the Muse," I continued, fixing first Dara and then Natia with a stark stare. "I seek to resolve it. Today. In fact, at this very moment. Now, I can do that in public, in front of both companies of Skyriders, or I can do it in private, between the commanders," I informed them. "Which do you prefer? It matters not to me." "In private, please, Master," my former apprentice requested, reminding all of them of her close relationship to me. "That would be agreeable, Excellency,"
Natia said after a pause. "Then walk with me, ladies," I said, turning away from them toward the corridor. "The rest of you, compose yourselves and calm your birds, and speak not a word to each other, lest I pluck you like capons," I commanded, as the two sky captains obediently followed. I led them to a parapet overlooking the broad courtyard between Megalyn's impressive towers. Below, a skeleton crew of workers and infantry scurried across the flagstones on their errands. Above, the robust spring winds blew thick wads of clouds overhead. "I need this to end," I said simply, once we were alone.
"Excellency,"
Natia began, "my riders were provoked. They took exception to being called rebels," Dara corrected, "which they are, Master." "I need this to end," I repeated more forcefully. "Natia was assigned to Timberwatch, if you recall," I reminded Dara. "She was supposed to return from Timberwatch, if you recall," Dara replied, "along with those birds." "I had need of them in the Wilderlands," I insisted, "and the Muse Tower in Sevendor wasn't complete. It was overcrowded at the time. Splitting the Muse was necessary. It would have happened if you two had quarreled or not. Keeping all of the giant hawks in one place wasn't useful or wise. It is unfortunate that the split happened at the same time you argued, but that is how it happened. The acrimony, however, did not have to happen," I continued. "Regardless of your personal matters, this should never have affected your riders. That's sloppy commanding," I added, earning a wince from both women. "Sloppy commanding leads to dead riders and dead birds. No one wants that." "If her Muse would quit calling us rebels," Natia proposed heatedly, "we wouldn't." "They will," I promised. "At once." "Dara, that's an order. Blame it on me if you wish, but that stops now," I said, to which the Hawk Maiden nodded. "The Vanador wing seems determined to cast aspersions on my character," Dara said, with less fire but more steel in her voice than Natia had managed, "especially in regard to my—" "In your rejection of Gareth," I supplied, unwilling to let her be vague about the matter. "I'm aware of the incident. I also know you regret the severity and the manner of your words at the time. Shall I summon the Lord Steward to hear that in person?" I suggested, as Dara turned pale.
I don't think," she stuttered.
She certainly wanted to talk to him last year, Natia sneered. If he'd had the courage to speak with me, he would have heard my explanation then, Dara shot back. Aye, and an apology. I do regret what I said to him, but what you said to me was no better, she insisted to Natia. My heart is mine to keep, and I will suffer no other woman to judge it. As is Gareth's, his, Natia declared hotly. If he retreated in the face of such humiliation, instead of seeking some petty retribution, then credit him for his courtesy and his loyalty to the friendship you once had, instead of doubting his courage. The man faced them a Vorty to earn your favour, and you doubt his courage, she said contemptuously. Am I more fearsome than a Nemavort? Dara asked angrily. Nor was my relationship with Gareth any of your concern. You made it my concern, and the concern of the entire Muse Tower when you shamed him in our midst. If we are rebels, we rebel against discourtesy, Natia defended. My ladies, I interrupted, as I was at risk of losing their attention to their argument. This settles nothing. Natia, you are offended at Dara's outburst at Gareth, in part because your own heart desires him, and you are fiercely loyal to him. But, she tried to interrupt, blushing at the accusation. Hush, Natia, I said gently. I'm spellmongering. While your loyalty to Lord Gareth does you credit, in my experience allowing it to constrain your actions can be a hazard. You pass judgment on your friend. For Dara is, yet, your friend, though you quarrel. For a hot-headed action she took more than a year.